That's what you tell yourself. It's a form of neurosis, you know. When a man drowns himself in work, it's because he's trying to escape from something. You ought to have a hobby. Oh, Phil, for Christ's sake, he said, and regretted the irritation in his voice. Philip had always been in precarious health, though doctors had found no specific defect in his loose, gangling body. He was 38, but his chronic weariness made people think at times that he was older than his brother. You ought to learn to have some fun, said Philip. Otherwise you'll become dull and narrow. Single-tracked, you know. You ought to get out of your little private shell and take a look at the world. You don't want to miss life the way you're doing. Fighting anger, Reardon told himself that this was Philip's form of solicitude. He told himself that it would be unjust to feel resentment. They were all trying to show their concern for him. And he wished these were not the things they had chosen for concern. I had a pretty good time today, Phil, he answered, smiling, and wondered why Philip did not ask him what it was. He wished one of them would ask him. He was finding it hard to concentrate. The sight of the running metal was still burned into his mind, filling his consciousness, leaving no room for anything else. You might have apologized, only I ought to know better than to expect it. It was his mother's voice. He turned. She was looking at him with that injured look which proclaims the long-bearing patience of the defenseless. Mrs. Beecham was here for dinner, she said reproachfully. What? Mrs. Beecham. My friend Mrs. Beecham. Yes? I told you about her. I told you many times, but you never remember anything I say. Mrs. Beecham was so anxious to meet you, but she had to leave after dinner. She couldn't wait. Mrs. Beecham is a very busy person. She wanted so much to tell you about the wonderful work we're doing in our parish school, and about the classes in metal craftsmanship, and about the beautiful wrought iron doorknobs that the little slum children are making all by themselves. It took the whole of his sense of consideration to force himself to answer evenly. I'm sorry if I disappointed you, Mother. You're not sorry. You could have been here if you'd made the effort. But when did you ever make an effort for anybody but yourself? You're not interested in any of us or in anything we do. You think if you pay the bills, that's enough, don't you? Money, that's all you know. And all you give us is money. Have you ever given us any time? If this meant that she missed him, he thought, then it meant affection. And if it meant affection, then he was unjust to experience a heavy, murky feeling, which kept him silent, lest his voice betray that the feeling was disgust. You don't care, her voice went half spitting, half begging on. Lillian needed you today for a very important problem, but I told her it was no use waiting to discuss it with you. Oh, Mother, it's not important, said Lillian. Not to Henry. He turned to her. He stood in the middle of the room with his trench coat still on, as if he were trapped in an unreality that would not become real to him. It's not important at all, said Lillian gaily. He could not tell whether her voice was apologetic or boastful. It's not business. It's purely non-commercial. What is it? Just a party I'm planning to give. A party? Oh, don't look frightened. It's not for tomorrow night. I know that you're so very busy, but it's for 3 months from now, and I want it to be a very big, very special affair. So would you promise me to be here that night, and not in Minnesota or Colorado or California? She was looking at him in an odd manner, speaking too lightly and too purposefully at once, her smile overstressing an air of innocence, and suggesting something like a hidden trump card. 3 months from now, he said. But you know that I can't tell what urgent business might come up to call me out of town. Oh, I know. But couldn't I make a formal appointment with you, way in advance, just like any railroad executive, automobile manufacturer, or scrap dealer? They say you never miss an appointment. Of course, I'd let you pick the date to suit your convenience. She was looking up at him, her glance acquiring some special quality of feminine appeal by being sent from under her lowered forehead up toward his full height. She asked, a little too casually and too cautiously, "The date I had in mind was December 10th. But would you prefer the 9th or the 11th? It makes no difference to me, she said gently. December 10th is our wedding anniversary, Henry. They were all watching his face. If they expected a look of guilt, what they saw instead was a faint smile of amusement. She could not have intended this as a trap, he thought, because he could escape it so easily, by refusing to accept any blame for his forgetfulness, and by leaving her spurned. He knew that his feeling for her was her only weapon. Her motive, he thought, was a proudly indirect attempt to test his feeling and to confess her own. A party was not his form of celebration, but it was hers. It meant nothing in his terms. In hers, it meant the best tribute she could offer to him and to their marriage. He had to respect her intention, he thought, even if he did not share her standards, even if he did not know whether he still cared for any tribute from her. He had to let her win, he thought, because she had thrown herself upon his mercy. He smiled an open, unresentful smile in acknowledgment of her victory. "All right, Lillian," he said quietly. "I promise to be here on the night of December 10th. "Thank you, dear." Her smile had a closed, mysterious quality. He wondered why he had a moment's impression that his attitude had disappointed them all. If she trusted him, he thought, if her feeling for him was still alive, then he would match her trust. He had to say it. Words were a lens to focus one's mind, and he could not use words for anything else tonight. "I'm sorry I'm late, Lillian, but today at the mills we poured the first heat of Reardon metal." There was a moment of silence. Then Philip said, "Well, that's nice." The other said nothing. He put his hand in his pocket. When he touched it, the reality of the bracelet swept out everything else. He felt as he had felt when the liquid metal had poured through space before him. "I brought you a present, Lillian." He did not know that he stood straight, and that the gesture of his arm was that of a returning crusader offering his trophy to his love, when he dropped a small chain of metal into her lap. Lillian Reardon picked it up, hooked on the tips of two straight fingers, and raised it to the light. The links were heavy, crudely made. The shining metal had an odd tinge. It was greenish-blue. "What's that?" she asked. "The first thing made from the first heat of the first order of Reardon metal."
"You mean," she said, "it's fully as valuable as a piece of railroad rails?"
He looked at her blankly. She jingled the bracelet, making it sparkle under the light.
"Henry, it's perfectly wonderful. What originality. I shall be the sensation of New York, wearing jewelry made of the same stuff as bridge girders, truck motors, kitchen stoves, typewriters, and, what was it you were saying about it the other day, darling? Soup kettles."
"God, Henry, but you're conceited," said Philip. Lillian laughed.
"He's a sentimentalist, all men are. But, darling, I do appreciate it. It isn't the gift. It's the intention, I know."
"The intention's plain selfishness, if you ask me," said Reardon's mother. "Another man would bring a diamond bracelet if he wanted to give his wife a present, because it's her pleasure he'd think of, not his own. But Henry thinks that just because he's made a new kind of tin, why, it's got to be more precious than diamonds to everybody, just because it's he that's made it. That's the way he's been since he was 5 years old, the most conceited brat you ever saw, and I knew he'd grow up to be the most selfish creature on God's earth."
"No, it's sweet," said Lillian. "It's charming."
She dropped the bracelet down on the table. She got up, put her hands on Reardon's shoulders, and raising herself on tiptoe, kissed him on the cheek, saying, "Thank you, dear." He did not move, did not bend his head down to her. After a while he turned, took off his coat, and sat down by the fire apart from the others. He felt nothing but an immense exhaustion. He did not listen to their talk. He heard dimly that Lillian was arguing, defending him against his mother.
"I know him better than you do," his mother was saying. "Hank Reardon's not interested in man, beast, or weed unless it's tied in some way to himself and his work. That's all he cares about. I've tried my best to teach him some humility. I've tried all my life, but I failed."
He had offered his mother unlimited means to live as and where she pleased. He wondered why she had insisted that she wanted to live with him. His success, he had thought, meant something to her. And if it did, then it was a bond between them, the only kind of bond he recognized. If she wanted a place in the home of her successful son, he would not deny it to her.
"It's no use hoping to make a saint out of Henry, Mother," said Philip. "He wasn't meant to be one." Oh, but Philip, you're wrong, said Lillian. You're so wrong. Henry has all the makings of a saint. That's the trouble. What did they seek from him, thought Reardon? What were they after? He had never asked anything of them. It was they who wished to hold him, they who pressed a claim on him. And the claim seemed to have the form of affection. But it was a form which he found harder to endure than any sort of hatred. He despised causeless affection, just as he despised unearned wealth. They professed to love him for some unknown reason, and they ignored all the things for which he could wish to be loved. He wondered what response they could hope to obtain from him in such manner, if his response was what they wanted. And it was, he thought. Else why those constant complaints, those unceasing accusations about his indifference? Why that chronic air of suspicion, as if they were waiting to be hurt? He had never had a desire to hurt them, but he had always felt their defensive, reproachful expectation. They seemed wounded by anything he said. It was not a matter of his words or actions. It was almost as if they were wounded by the mere fact of his being. Don't start imagining the insane, he told himself severely, struggling to face the riddle with the strictest of his ruthless sense of justice. He could not condemn them without understanding, and he could not understand. Did he like them? No, he thought. He had wanted to like them, which was not the same. He had wanted it in the name of some unstated potentiality which he had once expected to see in any human being. He felt nothing for them now, nothing but the merciless zero of indifference, not even the regret of a loss. Did he need any person as part of his life? Did he miss the feeling he had wanted to feel? No, he thought. Had he ever missed it? Yes, he thought, in his youth. Not any longer. His sense of exhaustion was growing. He realized that it was boredom. He owed them the courtesy of hiding it, he thought, and sat motionless, fighting a desire for sleep that was turning into physical pain. His eyes were closing when he felt two soft, moist fingers touching his hand. Paul Larkin had pulled a chair to his side and was leaning over for a private conversation. I don't care what the industry says about it, Hank. You've got a great product in Reardon Metal, a great product. It will make a fortune, like everything you touch. Yes, said Reardon. It will. I just hope you don't run into trouble. What trouble? Oh, I don't know. The way things are nowadays, there's people who... But how can we tell? Anything can happen. What trouble? Larkin sat hunched, looking up with his gentle, pleading eyes. His short, plumpish figure always seemed unprotected and incomplete, as if he needed a shell to shrink into at the slightest touch. His wistful eyes, his lost, helpless, appealing smile, served as substitute for the shell. The smile was disarming, like that of a boy who throws himself at the mercy of an incomprehensible universe. He was 53 years old. Your public relations aren't any too good, Hank, he said. You've always had a bad press. So what? You're not popular, Hank. I haven't heard any complaints from my customers. That's not what I mean. You ought to hire yourself a good press agent to sell you to the public. What for? It's steel that I'm selling. But you don't want to have the public against you. Public opinion, you know, it can mean a lot. I don't think the public's against me. And I don't think that it means a damn one way or another. The newspapers are against you. They have time to waste. I haven't. I don't like it, Hank. It's not good.
What?
What they write about you.
What do they write about me?
Well, you know the stuff. That you're intractable, that you're ruthless, that you won't allow anyone any voice in the running of your mills, that your only goal is to make steel and to make money.
But that is my only goal.
But you shouldn't say it.
Why not? What is it I'm supposed to say?
Oh, I don't know. But your mills...
They're my mills, aren't they?
Yes, but... But you shouldn't remind people of that too loudly. You know how it is nowadays. They think that your attitude is antisocial.
I don't give a damn what they think.
Paul Larkin sighed.
What's the matter, Paul? What are you driving at?
Nothing. Nothing in particular. Only one never knows what can happen in times like these. One has to be so careful. Reardon chuckled. You're not trying to worry about me, are you?
It's just that I'm your friend, Hank. I'm your friend. You know how much I admire you.
Paul Larkin had always been unlucky. Nothing he touched ever came off quite well. Nothing ever quite failed or succeeded. He was a businessman, but he could not manage to remain for long in any one line of business. At the moment, he was struggling with a modest plant that manufactured mining equipment. He had clung to Reardon for years in awed admiration. He came for advice. He asked for loans at times, but not often. The loans were modest and were always repaid, though not always on time. His motive in the relationship seemed to resemble the need of an anemic person who receives a kind of living transfusion from the mere sight of a savagely overabundant vitality. Watching Larkin's efforts, Reardon felt what he did when he watched an ant struggling under the load of a matchstick. It's so hard for him, thought Reardon, and so easy for me. So he gave advice, attention, and a tactful, patient interest whenever he could. I'm your friend, Hank. Reardon looked at him inquiringly. Larkin glanced away as if debating something in his mind. After a while, he asked cautiously, How is your man in Washington?
Okay, I guess.
You ought to be sure of it. It's important. He looked up at Reardon and repeated with a kind of stressed insistence, as if discharging a painful moral duty, Hank, it's very important.
I suppose so.
In fact, that's what I came here to tell you.
For any special reason?
Larkin considered it, and decided that the duty was discharged. No, he said.
Reardon disliked the subject.
He knew that it was necessary to have a man to protect him from the legislature. All industrialists had to employ such men. But he had never given much attention to this aspect of his business. He could not quite convince himself that it was necessary. An inexplicable kind of distaste, part fastidiousness, part boredom, stopped him whenever he tried to consider it. Trouble is, Paul, he said, thinking aloud, that the men one has to pick for that job are such a crummy lot. Larkin looked away. That's life, he said. Damned if I can see why. Can you tell me that? What's wrong with the world? Larkin shrugged sadly. Why ask useless questions? How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? Who is John Galt? Reardon sat up straight. No, he said sharply. No, there's no reason to feel that way. He got up. His exhaustion had gone while he talked about his business. He felt a sudden spurt of rebellion, a need to recapture and defiantly to reassert his own view of existence, that sense of it which he had held while walking home tonight, and which now seemed threatened in some nameless manner. He paced the room, his energy returning. He looked at his family. They were bewildered, unhappy children, he thought, all of them, even his mother, and he was foolish to resent their ineptitude. It came from their helplessness, not from malice. It was he who had to make himself learn to understand them, since he had so much to give, since they could never share his sense of joyous, boundless power. He glanced at them from across the room. His mother and Philip were engaged in some eager discussion, but he noted that they were not really eager. They were nervous. Philip sat in a low chair, his stomach forward, his weight on his shoulder blades, as if the miserable discomfort of his position were intended to punish the onlookers. "What's the matter, Phil?" Reardon asked, approaching him. "You look done in." "I've had a hard day," said Philip sullenly. "You're not the only one who works hard," said his mother. "Others have problems, too, even if they're not billion-dollar trans-supercontinental problems like yours."
"Why, that's good. I always thought that Phil should find some interest of his own."
"Good? You mean you like to see your brother sweating his health away? It amuses you, doesn't it? I always thought it did."
"Why, no, Mother. I'd like to help."
"You don't have to help. You don't have to have feeling for any of us."
Reardon had never known what his brother was doing or wished to do. He had sent Philip through college, but Philip had not been able to decide on any specific ambition. There was something wrong, by Reardon's standards, with a man who did not seek any gainful employment. But he would not impose his standards on Philip. He could afford to support his brother and never notice the expense. Let him take it easy, Reardon had thought for years. Let him have a chance to choose his career without the strain of struggling for a livelihood. What were you doing today, Phil? He asked patiently.
It wouldn't interest you.
It does interest me. That's why I'm asking.
I had to see 20 different people all over the place, from here to Reading to Wilmington.
What did you have to see them about?
I'm trying to raise money for Friends of Global Progress.
Reardon had never been able to keep track of the many organizations to which Philip belonged, nor to get a clear idea of their activities. He had heard Philip talking vaguely about this one for the last 6 months. It seemed to be devoted to some sort of free lectures on psychology, folk music, and cooperative farming. Reardon felt contempt for groups of that kind, and saw no reason for a closer inquiry into their nature. He remained silent. Philip added without being prompted,
We need $10,000 for a vital program, but it's a martyr's task trying to raise money. There's not a speck of social conscience left in people. When I think of the kind of bloated money bags I saw today, why, they spend more than that on any whim, but I couldn't squeeze just $100 apiece out of them, which was all I asked. They have no sense of moral duty. No.
What are you laughing at? He asked sharply. Reardon stood before him, grinning. It was so childishly blatant, thought Reardon, so helplessly crude. The hint and the insult offered together. It would be so easy to squash Philip by returning the insult, he thought, by returning an insult which would be deadly because it would be true, that he could not bring himself to utter it. Surely, he thought, the poor fool knows he's at my mercy, knows he's opened himself to be hurt, so I don't have to do it, and my not doing it is my best answer, which he won't be able to miss. What sort of misery does he really live in, to get himself twisted quite so badly? And then Reardon thought suddenly that he could break through Philip's chronic wretchedness for once, give him a shock of pleasure, the unexpected gratification of a hopeless desire. He thought, what do I care about the nature of his desire? It's his, just as Reardon metal was mine. It must mean to him what that meant to me. Let's see him happy just once. It might teach him something. Didn't I say that happiness is the agent of purification? I'm celebrating tonight, so let him share in it. It will be so much for him, and so little for me. Philip, he said, smiling. Call Miss Ives at my office tomorrow. She'll have a check for you for $10,000. Philip stared at him blankly. It was neither shock nor pleasure. It was just the empty stare of eyes that looked glassy. Oh, said Philip. Then added, We'll appreciate it very much. There was no emotion in his voice. Not even the simple one of greed. Reardon could not understand his own feeling. It was as if something leaden and empty were collapsing within him. He felt both the weight and the emptiness together. He knew it was disappointment, but he wondered why it was so gray and ugly. It's very nice of you, Henry, Philip said dryly. I'm surprised. I didn't expect it of you. Don't you understand it, Phil? Said Lillian, her voice peculiarly clear and lilting. Henry's poured his mettle today. She turned to Reardon. Shall we declare it a national holiday, darling? You're a good man, Henry, said his mother, and added, but not often enough. Reardon stood looking at Philip as if waiting. Philip looked away, then raised his eyes and held Reardon's glance, as if engaged in a scrutiny of his own. You don't really care about helping the underprivileged, do you? Philip asked. And Reardon heard, unable to believe it, that the tone of his voice was reproachful. No, Phil, I don't care about it at all. I only wanted you to be happy. But that money is not for me. I'm not collecting it for any personal motive. I have no selfish interest in the matter whatever. His voice was cold, with a note of self-conscious virtue. Reardon turned away. He felt a sudden loathing, not because the words were hypocrisy, but because they were true. Philip meant them.
By the way, Henry,
Philip added,
do you mind if I ask you to have Miss Ives give me the money in cash?
Reardon turned back to him, puzzled.
You see, Friends of Global Progress are a very progressive group, and they have always maintained that you represent the blackest element of social retrogression in the country. So it would embarrass us, you know, to have your name on our list of contributors, because somebody might accuse us of being in the pay of Hank Reardon.
He wanted to slap Philip's face,
but an almost unendurable contempt made him close his eyes instead.
All right, he said quietly. You can have it in cash. He walked away to the farthest window of the room and stood looking at the glow of the mills in the distance. He heard Larkin's voice crying after him.
Damn it, Hank! You shouldn't have given it to him!
Then Lillian's voice came, cold and gay.
But you're wrong, Paul. You're so wrong. What would happen to Henry's vanity if he didn't have us to throw alms to? What would become of his strength if he didn't have weaker people to dominate? What would he do with himself if he didn't keep us around as dependents? It's quite all right, really. I'm not criticizing him. It's just a law of human nature.
She took the metal bracelet and held it up, letting it glitter in the lamplight.
A chain, she said.
Appropriate, isn't it? It's the chain by which he holds us all in bondage. Chapter 3. The Top and the Bottom. The ceiling was that of a cellar, so heavy and low that people stooped when crossing the room, as if the weight of the vaulting rested on their shoulders. The circular booths of dark red leather were built into walls of stone that looked eaten by age and dampness. There were no windows, only patches of blue light shooting from dents in the masonry, the dead blue light proper for use in blackouts. The place was entered by way of narrow steps that led down as if descending deep under the ground. This was the most expensive barroom in New York, and it was built on the roof of a skyscraper. Four men sat at a table. Raised 60 floors above the city, they did not speak loudly as one speaks from a height in the freedom of air and space. They kept their voices low, as befitted a cellar.
Conditions and circumstances, Jim, said Orrin Boyle. Conditions and circumstances, absolutely beyond human control. We had everything mapped to roll those rails, but unforeseen developments set in, which nobody could have prevented. If you'd only given us a chance, Jim.
Disunity, drawled James Taggart, seems to be the basic cause of all social problems. My sister has a certain influence with a certain element among our stockholders. Their disruptive tactics cannot always be defeated.
You said it, Jim. Disunity, that's the trouble. It's my absolute opinion that in our complex industrial society, no business enterprise can succeed without sharing the burden of the problems of other enterprises. Taggart took a sip of his drink and put it down again.
I wish they'd fire that bartender, he said.
For instance, consider Associated Steel. We've got the most modern plant in the country and the best organization. That seems to me to be an indisputable fact because we got the Industrial Efficiency Award of Globe magazine last year. So we can maintain that we've done our best, and nobody can blame us. But we cannot help it if the iron ore situation is a national problem. We could not get the ore, Jim.
Taggart said nothing. He sat with his elbows spread wide on the tabletop. The table was uncomfortably small, and this made it more uncomfortable for his three companions. But they did not seem to question his privilege.
Nobody can get ore any longer, said Boyle. Natural exhaustion of the mines, you know, and the wearing out of equipment and shortages of materials and difficulties of transportation and other unavoidable conditions.
The ore industry is crumbling. That's what's killing the mining equipment business, said Paul Larkin.
It's been proved that every business depends upon every other business, said Orrin Boyle. So everybody ought to share the burdens of everybody else.
That is, I think, true, said Wesley Mooch. But nobody ever paid any attention to Wesley Mooch.
My purpose, said Orrin Boyle, is the preservation of a free economy. It's generally conceded that free economy is now on trial. Unless it proves its social value and assumes its social responsibilities, the people won't stand for it. If it doesn't develop a public spirit, it's done for. Make no mistake about that.